So we've been talking about music today and saying, what do these songs have in common? So you've got your Procol Harum with the classic A Whiter Shade of Pale. You've got more modern, Dancing in the Moonlight by Top Loader. The Wonderful Crowded House. And Don't Dream It's Over. And I can offer you Manfred Mann's Earth Band and Blinded by the Light. Listen to this sound. What a great sound. Blinded by the light. All of those songs featured a Hammond organ. And if you Google Hammond organ, you will find out that it was the first electronic musical instrument to become commercially successful. But forget that. The impact it had on pop music is what's given it its treasured status. Well, Graham Slater was a musician in the 1960s, and he had a Hammond organ, and he played it with some of the best.
I found my thrill.
Got a friend. You got a friend, yeah. Ain't it good to know you got a friend? Ain't it good to know you got a friend? Oh yeah, yeah. You've got a friend.
Genuine bona fide legends there. Fats Domino, Jimi Hendrix, James Taylor. Graham has played with them all in one way or another. And Graham is now an author and a scriptwriter, and he's here. Good afternoon.
Hi, Simon. What a build-up. My goodness me.
Well, what a CV you sent us, though. So, I mean, gosh, we have so many things we need to talk about. We will talk about the career as a writer very soon indeed. But please forgive me, indulge me. We've been asking people to tell us their stories involving Hammond organs. From your end, as a musician who played one in the 60s, what was it about the Hammond organ? Just to sort of sum up the magic of it.
It was unique, and as you said, it was one of the first successful electronic instruments, really, that took off. But what it was for people who played it was the variation you could have in the sound. The percussion in it, you could leave the percussion out. You had two manuals, which was great. Although a lot of Hammond organists or people who played organs seldom used the left hand or the bottom keyboard, but I used to use both. And I was watching a video last night of a group of session guys in America playing Misty, which is one of my favorite songs. And the guy was brilliant, but he only used the one hand. And I think using the left hand with odd chords and stabs really lifts it out, you know. But it was a special instrument. It was unique. And I know when I was in Germany and Europe, apart from Procol Harum, who I met in Sweden the day after I jammed with Jimi Hendrix, that was the only Hammond that I saw. People didn't have them, you know. So Christine Perfect, who went on to Fleetwood Mac, you know, loved playing it. And Tony Ashton from Ashton, Gardner and Dyke, they all loved playing the Hammond. Elton John loved playing my Hammond. They all loved playing it because it was the only one around, and I know I took out HP on it, and at the time, it was the cost of a Mini.
Wow. But money well spent, absolutely money well spent. It wouldn't fit in a Mini, I suspect. You'd never get it in the boot. But
what happened, Simon, sorry to interrupt you there, what happened was Steve Winwood got one, a lot of other people. It really became popular in the later 60s, and what they did, they cut them in half. So they were easier to carry. They cut them not down the middle, but across.
Wow.
And they cut them in half and then used sort of special clips to clip it together and cables to clip them all together, which made it much easier. And you still wouldn't get it in a Mini, but
no.
You get it in a car, certainly.
Oh, I love that you cut them in half. That's great. And of course, you know, we're going back to a time when we didn't have synthesizers. And so you know, to go from a piano and a pipe organ to this electronic kit of parts, like you say, that could produce very different sounds. I mean, it's no wonder why it kind of changed pop music in terms of the sounds that were available.
Totally. I mean, the only really... Well, there were two organs that were around that were popular. Was the Farfisa, which was used on Del Shannon's Runaway, which was quite a thick sound, and then a very, what I call, wiry sound, which was the Vox Continental with reverse keys, which Alan Price used to play, of course, and he used that on all the Animal songs, and when he went off on his own. Georgie Fame played a Hammond and a Lowry, but, it really made... It gave a musician room to create the sounds, yeah. And that was what made it so very, very special.
As you were talking about the Hammond, you did us a couple of name drops that we have to flesh out the details. So, firstly, you jammed with Jimi Hendrix, and now this was one of those moments that you probably at the time pinched yourself when it happened, and probably looking back, think, God, what a lovely bit of coincidence that he turned up when he did.
Well, it was. I mean, we were in Gothenburg in Sweden, and we were there for the month. And about 5 nights before I met him in the club, they changed the side of the road that they drove on. They were used to drive on the left, the same as us, and they decided after many years that they would drive on the same side as Germany and Denmark and all the other countries. So traffic stopped. But the following Friday, he was playing in Gothenburg. And he walked, and we'd already finished our gig at a club, and we drove back to the Atlantic Hotel, and in the basement was a club called the Q Club. So we were in there having a drink, and he walked in with Chas Chandler and Mitch Mitchell, his drummer. And I'd put my drink down, walked up to Jimmy and said, do you fancy getting up for a jam? Now, years later, I knew that he loved doing that, but at the time, I didn't know that. So he said, yeah, if you get the kit in, I'll get up with you. So we brought the gear in. And now in those days, of course, the Hammond, you plug it straight into an amp. I didn't have a Leslie speaker, but you plug it straight into an amp. The bass player plugged in, Alan, Peter brought in his drums. And that took longer to set up the drums than anything. But once that was done, and our couple of columns, literally plug-in microphones, and we got up. And we jammed for almost 2 hours. And what I found incredible, and it's something that I've thought about a lot when I watch other people in anything in life. When you are playing with someone like that, you actually rise to the occasion. And I say to anyone, I've never played better than I played that night.
Wow. But just to be in the presence of, and then to have the foresight to dare to ask, come on, Jimmy, fancy coming and jamming, what a brilliant thing. Because probably that didn't happen to him much because of his status, I guess.
Well, it didn't, no. I mean, he did like to jam. I mean, he wanted Steve Winwood to join him, actually, because he loved the Hammond organ. But I didn't know any of that at the time. But one thing that I still have on me, which embarrasses me to this day, I kept asking if he was going to sing. And he wouldn't. So it was literally all instrumental stuff. I'd start a riff and he'd follow it and vice versa. Or Mitch would start sort of a tempo and we'd sort of click into that. But what I realised that he hated his voice, although I think it works really well on all his records. Like a lot of people, they don't think Stevie Marriott was the same. He didn't think he was a good guitarist. But everyone's good at what they do. It's just at different levels, you know. So I was a bit embarrassed that I repeatedly asked him if he was going to sing. Are you going to sing something? You know, I mean, it probably would have been just throwaway melody and vocals, you know. But he was in love with the guitar as opposed to his voice.
Yeah. Well, and played it in such a distinctive way, didn't he? What an amazing man. And to have been on the stage with him, let alone in the same room as him, is probably enough for most of us. But let's talk about Elton John, because yeah. You lent Elton John your Hammond organ, although he wasn't the Elton John we know and love.
It was Reg Twite, and it was the Top Ten Club in Hamburg, which is on the main Reeperbahn drag down the bottom on the right. And we were booked, same band, we were booked, the Manchester Playboys, we were booked to play at the Top Ten Club. I played there several times, but with different bands, but we were booked to play there. And at the Top Ten, because it opened at about 7 in the evening and went on until 3, 4, even 5 in the morning at weekends when it was busy, club owners only kept going. The motto to us was, as long as we're selling beer, you keep playing, and we cover the cost of the electricity. That was their motto. So there were two bands. There was us and Bluesology, similar sort of bands in a way. We were a soul band, and Bluesology were a bit more of a jazz sort of band. But there was only room. It was just, the stage was split into two levels. So up on the top was one set of drums and my Hammond. So we had a situation where obviously we couldn't put another electric piano or anything on the stage or another set of drums. So Reg, as he was then, used my Hammond and played it for the month until they came back to London, and then he went off on his own. So we got on very, really, really well, and you know, to have him playing it. But it was about 8 years later when I was doing a lot of session work in London, and I bumped into John Reed, his manager. I met him in the Colton and in Cannes over there. But when we came back, they'd set up the Rocket Records in South Audley Street. So I then did a couple of sessions with him playing the Hammond, and of course reminded him, and he did remember. So he should. he remembered that month that we had in Hamburg, because he was similar age to me. I was 16 when I went over. I think he was probably about 18 or 19 then, which was my age, because I think we're both born in 1947.
Right.
But I went to Germany when I was 16, which was underage then. You had to be 18 to play in the clubs, but I was underage. But he would have probably been, this was probably about, it's 1967 or early 68, so he would have been old enough to have played there. I was about 18 or 19 then.
How amazing. But how lovely to have seen him at the start pre his career as Elton John, and then to meet him a few years later when he was kind of, you know, riding on the crest of a wave. What a thing.
Well, very much so. I mean, it's funny how life works out, though, Simon. I mean, I'm sure you've had times in your life where you think, am I going to be doing this? Am I going to be doing that? Or don't even think about it, because none of us really know what our direction in life is going to be. I think things sometimes just happen, or it's because you want it so bad that it happens. But
yeah.
I don't think he certainly didn't realise that he was a great piano player. Hammond, very different. Playing the Hammond and a piano were totally different feel and way of playing. He loved it, and he mastered it, of course.
Well, I mean, he's just the success he went on to. And, you know, it was only when I saw the film Rocket Man that I had any idea of how enormous he was in America when he first burst onto the scene, because I would have been sort of too young to have any handle on what it was. But my goodness me, what an amazing start. I mean, just to have been in the same room as him, again, is one of those things where you think that'd do for most of us. We're talking about looking forward and in terms of when you're young and you don't know where your career is going to take you. In more recent times, you started looking back, and this is where the writing comes in that you wrote a book kind of loosely based on your life in the band in Hamburg. The book was called Ticket to Ride. How did it come about?
Well, I had kidney cancer, renal cancer, in 2004, and I'd already... I'd always wanted to write about it, and I started actually before I actually got married, when I moved back to London, and it's when I worked with James Taylor. If we have time, we'll talk about that. But I started to jot down things, but it wasn't until I was in my, and that was 1920 then, but it wasn't until I was in my, I'd say 60s, late 50s, early 60s, that I understood what I'd done. Because to me, it all seemed quite natural, and some things were quite horrific in a way. But, you know, you get through it and you think, well, it's normal for everyone else. And when I had my kidney out, I had 3 months to sit back and not do anything, or couldn't do anything. So that's when I decided to start. But because I'd matured mentally and life had moved on, I was able to look back at what I'd done in a very different way. It's like you say about sitting in the same room as Jimmy or whatever. You know, at the time it was normal, perfectly normal thing to do. But once you look back on it and realise and remember the things, some of the horrific things and great times and everything else, you look at it in a different way. And so I was able to start writing. So I wrote it, as I call, a work of faction. So everything in Ticket to Ride actually happened, but not necessarily to me, because I saw an awful lot. I mean, Hamburg was at the time in the 60s one of the most violent cities in the world, and I'd seen people stabbed, I'd seen girls stabbed, even then acid attacks, murders, you walk over bodies. I mean, it really was like that.
Oh my gosh, pretty horrific stuff for a young man to be witnessing.
But I thought it was natural. It's weird because we're in it and you're in the moment and you're walking in the Star Club and you're coming out and you've got all the fights and the hassles and goodness knows what. And then you go in the bar and have a few drinks back on stage, living with prostitutes, pimps and strippers. They were our life because when we finished at a lot of the clubs at 3 or 4 in the morning, they were the only people that were still around unless the drunks who couldn't get home.
So like you say, as you sort of looked back, you kind of formed a faction, great word. So fact, but in a fictional story, and that got the writing going.
Yeah, but because I was away for almost 5 years, I didn't want to do it as a journal or anything. So I really concentrated and consolidated it into about 15 months. So it started with me, the book starts with me coming home with terrible health issues. I won't go into that, but terrible health issues. And then I take the book back to me being asked by 4 strangers here in Exeter to go to an audition at Charlie Chester's club in Soho with a view of going to Germany. And I didn't think we'd get it, of course, but we did. And I was training to be a surveyor then as an apprentice, and I never went back to work. And then in the December of 63, we're in this little gasboard van, driving across Europe to Hamburg and arriving there to play on the 1st of January, 64.
What an amazing thing. Well, and what a lovely twist as well. Can I just say, I love the fact that you said, I never worked since, and which shows how much you loved your job. That's a brilliant thing.
We used to pinch ourselves. We're walking up the Reeperbahn because we lived in the red light district, which is St. Pauli in Hamburg. Wonderful area. I mean, there's so much going on there all the time. Everything's going on. Police station halfway up, and sirens going day and night. But we were actually in the middle of it, and we used to pinch ourselves. And what we used to think, we'd go into one of the Gaststätts or into one of the Schnellimbus for little cafes and have something to eat. And we used to look at each other and say, people at home are working now.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got proper jobs.
Yeah. And we even changed our passports to write musician. And I've seen George Harrison's original passport, and he had student on it. He crossed that out and put musician.
Oh, how brilliant. How brilliant. Well, now writer, and the most recent book you brought out was last year. It's called Born to Run. I've been reading through it. You write very much in a way, and we build you as an author and a script writer. And I could tell as I was reading the book that it would be a great film. This is kind of you've written it with a visual element to it.
That is my technique, and each chapter, of course, is a song title, which I think is quite unique. Apart from Ian Rankin, who in his most recent book, he used song titles. But yeah, I try to get the song title to link to what's in that chapter. But yeah, it's got everything in it. But I do write visually, and as I write, I want people to be there, and the book before that, two before that, I Will Survive. A lot of that is set in Hamburg and in Berlin, and it's in 2000. And I've walked those streets in Hamburg. I've gone back Berlin, Helsinki, Tallinn. I've walked those streets and St. Petersburg in Russia to make it real, because it's got to be real. You've got to be there. And if you read it, it does come across to any reader.
Yeah. Well, and writing now, obviously, you know, the heady days of not working but working your socks off in far-flung foreign places playing music with legends. Now is writing your thing? Is that kind of, has that taken over as being the passion?
It is. I'm a music publisher and have been since 74. We set up the company. I was a songwriter then, and we've still got the company, Tabitha Music, which was going great. It's changed with streaming now. I mean, there's very little money in it, and I dread if I had an artist come to me now saying, I want to make it, because I'd say, well, where are you going to make it? Online, you know? Mm. But a lot of my time is writing, and I speak on the cruise ships. And I speak about music and all sorts of things, and I'm just planning now talks on a cruise when we're going to Stockholm and Copenhagen. So I'm going to link the Jimi Hendrix experience to that talk. And I also talk on the Beatles' early days in Hamburg when they went there as the Silver Beatles in 1960.
Yeah. Well, look, we will get you on again in the future and talk about that. But for now, if you need any help with planning the cruise and you want someone to help you chop a Hammond organ in half, I'll turn up with a saw. We'll get it in your luggage. No one will know. Graham, listen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Simon.
Author and scriptwriter, Graham Slater. has got a website. You can find out more about Graham and the books that he's written and the amazing life he's led. It's grahamslater.com. I'll just spell that for you. He's a G-R-A-H-A-M, Graham, and Slater is S-C-L-A-T-E-R. Grahamslater.com. As I say, you can find out more about Graham, his music, and his books on there. Right, 12:37. It's BBC Radio Summerside.